Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Last Empty Places, a journey through blank spots on the American map, by Peter Stark, narrated by Jay Ossing. Prologue. On cold January mornings, we four children would sit down to cornbread and bacon on the warmed plates my mother handed out, while a frigid draft, a thin wafer of stiff breeze, sliced at my chest. From my bench at the kitchen table, I would lean back against the thick, bare logs of the house, roughly squared, still showing the chip marks of the hand adz that shaped them 110 years earlier. Between the logs protruded globs of chinking, a tacky slew of horsehair and putty, packed not quite tight enough in my corner of the kitchen to block Wisconsin's bitter winter winds. This rough-hewn cabin was my romantic father's idea of the perfect home for his young family, one my mother had warmly retrofitted with rag rugs, blueprint curtains, a big stone fireplace. He loved the stories of the Scandinavian pioneers who penetrated the great forests of the upper Midwest to build a new life from the wilderness, and told us of the Potawatomi Indians for whom this wilderness was home. A man named John Rudberg, one of the first Swedes to immigrate to Wisconsin territory, had hewn these logs with his own hands in 1849 near the shores of a beautiful lake known to the Indians as Shanaqua, or Pine Lake. My parents had discovered the old cabin inside an abandoned resort hotel on the shore of the lake. A house had eventually been built using Rudberg's original cabin as its core, and then the resort hotel around the house. As the hotel was torn down, revealing the cabin, my parents marked each log, extracted them, and reassembled them on a nearby piece of land they had purchased. This is where I grew up, in Rudberg's rebuilt old pioneer cabin surrounded by oak forest, with our nearest neighbor, an old dairy farmer, who, still running a team of workhorses, lived a quarter mile away, through forest and pasture. As a boy, I spent hours searching for arrowheads buried in our log walls. I loved to think of our cabin as a lonely bastion in the vast Wisconsin wilderness of the 1840s, the young Swedish pioneers spending their days swinging axes to finish their dwellings or clear their fields, chased indoors by the occasional Indian attack. I roamed the oak forests, the hills and valleys around our cabin, searching out the wildest spot, loving it best in a howling blizzard when the wind moaned through the bare oak branches and the deep, soft snow muted my bundled movements. In some subconscious 9-year-old's way, I understood that as an American, I had inherited this legacy of wilderness, that it shaped my forebears and me and all those who immigrated to this country, as the continent had shaped those Native Americans who were already here. I sensed, too, that it didn't lie so very far away. Only 3 generations, more or less, had passed since John Rudberg lived out his elemental drama within these same log walls. Every day, along with my 2 sisters and my brother, I attended the country grade school 2 miles away. Many of my classmates, with their Scandinavian or German last names, had young hands tough as cowhide from their daily chores on dairy farms that their great-grandparents had cleared like Rudberg. I doubt that any of the farm boys read the copy of The Story of My Boyhood and Youth by John Muir that sat on our classroom bookshelf, but I did, several times. I felt a deep boyhood bond with young John Muir. In 1849, just when Rudberg was finishing his cabin, the 10-year-old Muir immigrated with his family from Scotland to Wisconsin and purchased a piece of wilderness forest at Fountain Lake, about 50 miles from where I grew up. Young John had loved to explore the Wisconsin woods and rivers and lakes, as I loved to do, too. But when he grew old enough to help with the crushingly heavy work of clearing the farm from the wilderness, his idol ended. He finally escaped when a talent for mechanical inventions gained him entrance to the University of Wisconsin. Here he was exposed not only to botany and geology, but to the era's great American thinkers on wilderness and nature, Emerson and Thoreau. They changed his life, propelling him toward a passionate advocacy of the great empty places, a prophet of the wilderness. Thoreau, likewise, figured in my own youth. I started high school in the late 1960s, at the height of the countercultural Back to the Land movement that embraced Thoreau and his Walden as its gospel. During the first Earth Day ever held, 1970, I was a 16-year-old sophomore helping to plant trees on our school grounds. I distinctly recall, in a kind of embarrassingly un-Thoreauvian irony, reading Walden that year while sitting in the orthodontist's waiting room about to get my braces removed. "If you're reading Thoreau," said my mother, who had trained at the University of Wisconsin as a landscape architect, "you should also read Aldo Leopold. He was an environmentalist far ahead of his time, and lived in Wisconsin, too." It would be years later that I read all the thinkers I address in this book, writers who, over the last three centuries, have transformed our ideas about wild nature, starting with Rousseau and William Bartram in the 18th century, then Coleridge and Wordsworth, Emerson and Thoreau, John Muir and Aldo Leopold. I've detected a common thread not only in the influence of Wisconsin's landscapes, but also in the countryside around Concord, Massachusetts, where Thoreau pondered nature, and outside Philadelphia, where William Bartram came of age, and even in Rousseau's home city of Geneva, Switzerland, sitting on its long lake at the foot of the Alps. It's this. All these thinkers grew up in landscapes that were half cultivated, half wild. Wisconsin, to me, is the perfect example. Its green, rolling farm fields, its knob-like glacial hills crowned with wild oak forests, its windy little streams leading through blackbird-trilling marshes, its blue pothole lakes spilling into gentle rivers. This patchwork of small-scale civilization and wild nature, as the Romantics came to call it, offers a fecund landscape for the imagination. I understand perfectly what John Muir or Henry Thoreau felt in their youthful ramblings through woods and fields. It's exactly what I felt, the urge to explore, to travel to the next little valley hidden in the woods. See what's back there. Check it out. What's going on today? A new pond full of snowmelt. A knee-high patch of mayapples with their umbrella leaves and green fruit. A thick-limbed white oak to climb. A marsh of croaking frogs. A good roaring storm. "For many years," wrote Thoreau, "I was self-appointed inspector of rainstorms and snowstorms." What's in there? What's out there? I sought the secret, hidden feel of the place. Something always pulled me farther. Something hidden. Something precious. Something back in there. I always wanted more of it. These patches of wild intermixed with a cultivated landscape were never quite large or wild enough. Virtually every one of these writers shared another emotional bond, as I do. Ruin threatened their precious landscapes. In certain eras, the threats converged powerfully, undeniably. From the mid-1700s onward, the Industrial Revolution gathered momentum in Europe, and its cities swelled, and factories clanked into existence. It's no coincidence that this is exactly when Rousseau first started to write lovingly of the emotional benefits to be gained in wild nature. The sentiment was soon embraced by the British Romantic poets in the 1790s and early 1800s, who watched their Green Isles patchwork of wild places chopped down and dug up to fire the steam engines that powered the Industrial Revolution. When the industrial onslaught landed in America, in the New England of the 1840s, Henry David Thoreau watched as railroad tracks were laid through his precious Concord woods and fields and along nearby Walden Pond. Emerson, his friend and mentor, bought 40 acres along the pond to save it from being logged. And it was here on Emerson's land that Henry Thoreau built his cabin. The tide of development surged all around him. Timber fellers cut the forest nearby, and work crews arrived at Walden in winter to saw out blocks of ice for Boston's summer refrigeration. This sense of imminent threat and destruction made what remained of wild nature all the more precious for Thoreau. While Thoreau scribbled away on his Walden manuscript, it took him many drafts and several years to write, John Muir and his family arrived at Fountain Lake in Wisconsin in 1849. There wasn't even a wagon track through the wilderness forest where they settled. A few years later, when Muir left the Fountain Lake farm to go off to the university, farms and wagon roads covered the landscape. That decade, the 1840s, was a pivotal period in how wilderness was perceived in America, mostly because it was disappearing so fast. I know how they felt, Thoreau and Muir and the others, because in my teens, I watched subdivisions move out from the city and pave over my fields with cul-de-sacs and self-consciously curving roads. Bulldozers advanced into those precious valleys of mine hidden in the woods, and sprawling houses with three-car garages and rolled-out sod lawns replaced the mysterious patches of May apples and my climbing oaks and my snowmelt ponds. For a time, it made me almost physically nauseated to see another new subdivision plowed into my landscapes. Finally, I moved away, to Montana, where I didn't have to watch it happen so fast, although it still goes on, nevertheless. My soulmate in this escape, John Muir, fled to the Sierra almost exactly a century before. That compulsion to seek out the wild, secret places, the blank spots, never left me, but has only grown stronger, and, with time and age and resources, extended over a greater geographical range, as it did for Muir, and Thoreau, and Bartram, and Leopold, too. The search has taken me over the decades to wild, empty regions of Africa and the hidden valleys of Tibet, to the ice fields of Greenland and forests of Manchuria, and many places between. The geographical search, however, accounts for only one part of the overall endeavor. Just as compelling, perhaps more so, is the quest to discover why places like this are important. Reading these wilderness philosophers, Thoreau, Muir, Leopold, I'm left with a deep sense that this is what drove them, too. From the time they were young, they felt an urge to seek out these wild places, to explore them, to ramble through them, to love them. In some ways, it was a search, as it's been for me, for a childhood paradise lost, to recapture those exciting jaunts through woods and fields and streams. As they grew older, however, these writers each tried to understand why these wild places were important, to each of them and to all of us. Thus, in this book, in the course of these journeys, I want to explore not only the blank spots themselves, but also to write about those who spent their lives thinking about these wild places and exploring them, and what they had to say about why these blank spots, these wild areas, were important. There is no one answer. The various answers put forth by these thinkers all build on one another, however, and each has a common theme. It has to do with understanding our own place as a species on this planet. It has to do with understanding our insignificance as individuals. Although he found writing excruciatingly difficult, John Muir was nonetheless a catchy phrase maker who pointed the direction. The clearest way into the universe is through a forest wilderness. While I've traveled all over the world in the last 40 years seeking out the empty wild places, first as a lone traveler, then as a writer, finally as the husband of a ready-to-go-at-any-moment vagabond, I've largely ignored my own country. Too settled, I've thought. Too civilized. Too developed. But is it really? Has wilderness been wiped off the face of America? Have all the empty places been blanketed with roads? With farmers' fields, with subdivisions, shopping malls, and the sprawling cities themselves? In my eagerness to find the truly remote spots of the world, had I too hastily dismissed my own country? You could pick up any Rand McNally road atlas and see the vast highway system thrown like a giant fishnet over the entire United States. Thick ribbons of red and blue, black and yellow, wrapped nearly every corner of every state. What empty places could survive this onslaught of asphalt? Yet I'd flown over a good deal of the country since I'd left Wisconsin 2.5 decades ago, and, lured by the emptier spaces of the northern Rockies, moved to the small university town of Missoula, Montana. Especially in the west, but in certain parts of the east also, you could look down from an airplane window at 30,000 feet and spot what appeared to be vast, roadless stretches. Miles upon miles of mountains or forests or badlands that, as far as I could tell, were largely untracked. What were these? I set up a lunch date with my friend Alex Philp, a specialist in both historical geography and geographic information systems. Philp works, among other things, with images of Earth from outer space. He quickly became my guru of blank spots. What you want to do is find the nighttime image of the U.S. taken from NASA's satellites, he told me over the phone. Look where the lights are. Then look at the places where they are not, the black holes. I think you'll be surprised at how many you'll find, even near the large urban centers in the east. When we met a few days later, I unfurled what's known as the nighttime map of the United States on the cafe table between us. Scruffily bearded, 40-ish, Jesuit-educated, and the father of two young girls, Philp half-closed his eyes behind his glasses, almost as if meditating over the satellite image on the table. He swept his hand across it. Like an image of the starry sky, the page was mostly black, except for a pattern of dots and swirls and clustered nodes of lights. See how this image is not rectilinear, not Cartesian. It's not based on grids and lines, the kind of map a land surveyor would make. It's much more of a viral pattern, a biological expression. Now, I don't mean to compare humans to viruses, but viruses need certain things to survive, and so do humans. For instance, water. Philp gestured to the image's left half, the west. Here, the dots and clusters of light lay much more sparsely scattered. You could almost draw a line down the center of the map, dividing the thick lights of the east from the sparse lights of the west. This is roughly where the 100th meridian runs, said Philp. He was referring to one of the lines of longitude inscribed on the globe from pole to pole. The 100th meridian runs down the center of North and South Dakota, Nebraska, through Kansas and Texas, and on south into Mexico. West of the 100th meridian, it becomes too dry to grow crops easily, Philp said. Very few people live there. A great galaxy of light exploded at the image's right side, New York City at its center, morphing into Boston and Washington. It looked a bit like a giant crab with legs radiating outward. Millions upon millions of house lights, street lights, headlights, apartment lights, fast food joints, toll plazas, parking lots, sports stadiums, shopping malls, factory compounds. But between these radiant eastern seaboard crab legs lay a few patches of utter blackness. Some appeared surprisingly large. Over the next several weeks, I spent hours staring at the nighttime map of the United States, comparing it with my Rand McNally and my Times Atlas. I discovered that some of the biggest black holes on the photo did, in fact, show on the map that they had a road or two running through them. The nighttime photo made it abundantly clear, however, that almost no one lived there. To add more layers to my understanding of what I was seeing, I made trips to the university library and scoured through the exploration and discovery shelves, digging out the journals of early explorers of North America, such as Henry Hudson, Jacques Cartier, and Samuel de Champlain. I cared less about the places they visited than the unknown lands they alluded to but never reached. I studied the brittle, sketchy maps folded among the leaves of the crumbling old accounts, tracing my finger over them for the empty spaces where there were no lines, no trails, no rivers, only phrases like terra incognita or unmapped. I went through my own shelves for my frayed and marked up copies of wilderness and nature philosophers, such as Thoreau, Emerson, and Rousseau, and refreshed my reading of the classics in the field of wilderness studies, Roderick Nash's Wilderness in the American Mind, and The Idea of Wilderness by Max Uhlschlager. These provide wide-ranging and incisive understanding of how our notion of wilderness has evolved over the centuries. And yes, I surfed the internet, although I found it less helpful than one might think in actually identifying blank spots, but very useful in digging out odd items of history. Generally, I avoided zooming in on places using Google Earth. It's very difficult to identify from those aerial photos how truly blank an area is. There can be dozens of houses hidden under tree canopies that you simply can't see from the aerial image. And I also didn't want to detract from the excitement of seeing these places for the first time with my own eyes. In narrowing my choices to 5 or 6 blank spots to explore, I followed some basic criteria. 1. I avoided U.S. national parks and designated federal wilderness areas, although I eventually made one exception to the latter. I wanted wild, empty places that were also relatively unknown and obscure. 2. While the West has more and larger empty spaces, I wanted to explore some blank spots in the East also. I excluded Alaska, as it's so well known for its wild areas. 3. I looked for compelling stories about the first European encounters with the American wilds and Native Americans. 4. Aware of the criticism that once you write about these places, they won't be blank anymore, I sought out wild areas that could use some help and attention to keep them wild. 5. Finally, I sought out places that have shaped America's greatest thinkers and their ideas about wilderness. I wanted the places to help tell how, over the centuries, our American idea of wilderness has evolved from a kind of satanic hell to a place of spiritual inspiration. And so off I went, sometimes with family in tow, sometimes alone. Over the course of 2.5 years, I explored my chosen blank spots. Part 1. Where the Acadians Disappeared in Northern Maine. From far off, it was said, you could hear the women and children screaming. If you'd been there, in Nova Scotia, they called it Acadia then, in September of 1755, you would have seen the women down on their knees along the dirt lane, pleading, praying, wailing, reaching up with extended arms as their men and boys were marched from the church at Grand Pré down to the British ships that waited with the high tide. All men and lads over the age of 10 had been summoned to meet at the church at this Nova Scotian port town at exactly 3 o'clock p.m. on September 5th. When 418 of the Acadians were gathered within the church, British soldiers barred the doors and windows. Colonel Winslow, the British commander, in a powdered wig, sat at a table surrounded by soldiers and read aloud from a document containing orders that supposedly originated with the king. It detailed the fate of these French-descended inhabitants of Nova Scotia, the Acadians, as the British soldiers went from port to round them up. His instructions and commands, to wit, that your lands and tenements, cattle and livestock of all kinds, are forfeited to the crown, together with all your other effects, except money and household goods, and that you yourselves are to be removed from this, his province. The decree was translated into French. The Acadians, most of them, didn't read or write. No one recorded their precise reaction at that moment in the church at Grand Pré more than 200 years ago, except as it lives on today in stories and songs among Acadian descendants in the bayous of Louisiana, deep in the north woods of Maine, and still in parts of Nova Scotia. We have instead the words of Colonel Winslow himself, who wrote that the Acadians were greatly struck. He couldn't understand the imprecations hurled his way in their ancient dialect of French. Inside the church at Grand Pré, the British pointed their muskets at the outraged Acadian men and boys. The Acadian ancestors had migrated from France and settled here, on this great peninsula of land they called Acadia, and we know as Nova Scotia, that hovers out in the Atlantic east of Maine. By the time the British read their decree at Grand Pré in September 1755, the Acadians had lived on the peninsula for a century and a half. They'd been among the very first permanent northern European migrants to the New World, arriving in 1606, even before the first British colonists founded Jamestown, far south in Virginia. The Acadians had hunted the forests for furs and for meat, fished the bays and coastlines, diked the tidal salt marshes into fields. Unlike many of the British settlers to the south, they'd lived harmoniously with the Indians, learned to craft birch bark canoes and snowshoes, traded with them, intermarried with them, raised Métis families. They trucked with the savages, as the British put it disgustedly. They were an independent, self-sufficient people, a people of the forests and the marshes and the rivers. Not quite French, not quite Indian, but both. Or, rather, a unique people that blended both. And now, the end had come for Acadia. The British had won the Great Peninsula from France in 1710 in a military victory. And for more than 40 years, during a time of peace between the two great empires, had let the Acadians be. But now war was again afoot between Britain and France. The Acadians, way out here on the remote fringes, on the vague borderlands between the two clashing worlds, were caught between. The heavy rain started as we drove our rental car up the New England coast toward northern Maine, toward the lands where fleeing Acadians had disappeared. After flying east from home in Montana, we'd spent the night outside Boston, in Concord, close by Thoreau's Walden Pond. That morning, in the motel's breakfast room, where the children gleefully made waffles on the do-it-yourself iron, the television had predicted rain for the next 4 to 5 days. As I paid the bill in the lobby, a fine, warm Gulf Stream drizzle was falling on the electric green motel lawn. A few hours later, on I-95, when our economy rental car reached L.L. Bean at Freeport, Maine, a blurry deluge crashed on the windshield and streamed up from the tires. At Bean's, I bought a tarp, poles to suspend it, extra tent stakes, and a new rain jacket to replace my old one, as it suddenly seemed woefully inadequate. As a kind of treat to myself, I also bought a new fly rod. For the children, already well outfitted with rain jackets and pants, Amy picked up a couple of extra insect head nets, the kind with brims. The previous night, over an expensive bistro dinner in Concord, she'd been much bemused by conjuring the image of me taking notes while wearing a head net propped up on sticks. "That's why it's blank where we're going," she choked through tears of laughter over her soup, to the children's bewilderment. "No one wants to live there, because of the bugs." But it was the prospect of rain that bothered me more than the threat of bugs. I was slightly cheered after we left the coast past Beans, heading inland, almost due north on I-95, and the rain tapered off. By the time we reached Medway, the gateway to the Maine woods, a couple of hours inland, the rain had stopped altogether. Stuffed to the ceiling with our camping gear, our little white car bumped off the dry highway and into the graveled parking lot of Nicotow Outfitters, a wood-sided building scattered with a few others beside the road. The late afternoon gloom and heavy gray skies held low over the pointy tips of the dense fir and spruce forest behind the shop. I was thinking, 5 days. That's a whole lot of rain on an 8-day canoe trip, especially on a wilderness river, with children, and no way out of the forest, except paddling onward into the cold downpour. "Are you Betsy?" I asked the wiry, blondish, 30-something woman who emerged from the shop to greet us, followed by a bouncy young black lab. "I am," she said. I later would learn that her mother's family, the Falloons, had settled here in the mid-1800s when Medway was still known as Nicotow, located at the forks of the east and west branches of the Penobscot River. Her husband, Galen Hale, held a regular job with the Maine Environmental Inspection Branch, while she ran their outfitting shop. Inside, fishing lures and billed hats and paddling gear lined the walls, along with a wide assortment of mosquito repellent. I inspected the varieties while she gamely showed our children, Molly, 11, and Skylar, 8, how the black lab, Nikki, could roll over.
"It's been so wet lately. I was out in my garden today, and the bugs were pretty bad."
"You'll want to bring plenty of bug dope," she said, in an accent full of dropped R's and open A's. I'd heard the same mantra, "bring plenty of bug dope," from at least 3 other Mainers, including her husband, Galen. From Montana, I'd spoken to him by phone several times, telling him I was looking for the emptiest, blankest spots on the map, as well as an outfitter to help us. "Do you know the St. John River?" I'd asked him.
"Yep," he replied, with that famous Mainer laconic brevity.
"Could he rent us canoes for it?"
"Yep."
"Could he guide us down it if we wanted?"
"Yep."
"Did he know the other rivers of northern Maine?"
"Yep."
Then, in a burst of loquaciousness, he volunteered his qualifications.
"I've been living here in Medway all my life. My family started..."
Sample complete. Ready to continue?